Coming up next on RCR, it's the dialogue with Dewa De Boer from politics.
So we sort of have a crossroads, as it were, here in New Zealand.
To power.
You know, when good men stand up, the spines of others are stiffened.
And culture.
Through times like this, you know, through adversity, you can see who you can trust, who you can rely on. You see who's standing with you, and all of these things are very, very valuable.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the dialogue. I hope you enjoyed all of this morning's shows with Jaspreet and Don, and that you also listened to the breakfast show with Paul Brennan this morning. I am your host, Dewa De Boer, and we will be talking about politics, power, and culture for the next 2 hours. And I may as well start the show with a reminder that I am going away on holiday for about a month. And so Simon O'Connor will be guest hosting the show next week. So I hope you look forward to that. Enjoy today's show, of course, but make sure you come back next week for what I am sure will be a great guest-hosted show. Don't just tune out because you've heard that I'm not going to be there. Do come back next week. We will have Simon O'Connor. But today, we will have an interview with Elliot Ikile from Hobson's Pledge, and he'll be back on the show to give us an update on all of the treaty and adjacent issues that they have been dealing with. After that, I had planned to have an update from a European guest, but something unfortunately came up at his end short notice. So I won't tell you any more than that, because I do hope to have him on the show later in November when he will be able to talk about it. But of course, that does mean I have a little bit of unexpected extra time to fill, but I'll reach for a few extra pieces of commentary that I have been wanting to cover later on. William McGimsey will join us for the weekly roundup, as always. He will likely fill in and guest host a show or two in my absence as well. We'll go over a few items of New Zealand history and a great battle from the Pacific Theatre of World War II. This time, we did have a World War II battle last week, and we will again this week, and we may go back in time in future episodes, but for now, it feels like a natural progression. And at the end of the show, my wife Amy will also join us with some of your feedback from the mailbag. So now, before Elliot joins us, let's listen to some classical music. I have sometimes had some requests to either do classical style pop music or classical fusion. So I've got a piano solo of the song Faded, composed by Alan Walker, and played here by a French pianist who goes by the name of Rossio. So enjoy, and as I said, we will be back with Elliot Ikile from Hobson's Pledge right after this piano solo. You're listening to The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text us your thoughts on 2057 or email inbox at realitycheck.radio. We are joined now by Elliot Ikile, who is a returning guest. Welcome back to the show, Elliot.
Oh, thank you so much, Dewa. Absolutely wonderful to be here. And you just a massive shout out to your audience as well.
Well, just for anyone who doesn't know the kind of history and context, you and I were both involved with the New Conservatives some years ago. That's sort of before that, even free speech protests was at least that was sort of the I think the point on which we met was defense of freedom of speech, and something that you and I have both continued to advocate for, at least freedom of political expression. And
yeah, it's been what, 2016, 17?
Yeah, it was around then. So we're sorting 7-8 years now.
Jeez.
And you've recently moved on to Hobson's Pledge, and as an ambassador, an advocate at Hobson's Pledge, you'll be across many of those issues. So you can give an update to our listeners, and maybe you and I can discuss some of the finer details. So the first point we're talking about, I think, was Matthew Hooton's recent attacks on Don Brash, calling him racist, and saying he was just appealing to, or that he was just appealing to racists. And then he backed off and he had to give an apology because Don Brash said that I'm gonna sue you for defamation because that's defamatory, saying that I'm racist. When really what Don Brash is arguing for is what I would call anti-racism. He's arguing that everyone should always be treated equally Everybody should be the same. There's no differences. You know, there shouldn't be any differences between people of different ethnicities or races or whatever you want to say. That's his position. And I think you can disagree with that and you can make an argument against it. But like calling him racist is the complete opposite of what he's doing. So you got involved into this. So I'm going to let you give a little bit of an overview of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it absolutely wild. I watched the interview and he was, this is my opinion, I think he was very unhinged. I think he was just very red-faced. And to me, at least, it seemed as if he was going off the reservation. He was just going crazy. So in his wordings, I would regard it as being highly defamatory. And, you know, there's been a lot of things going back and forward. I am privy, obviously, to a lot of what's going on between. So I can't say too much because there's a lot of process going on as we speak. There's a lot of things going back and forth. I was shocked at the level of what I would regard as venom and vitriol from Houghton. And it also started to, for me, I started looking at some of the things that he's been going on about over the last few years. And the mainstream media have termed him as a conservative. And I have to kick back on that. I don't think he is. I'm not exactly sure what he is. I mean, definitely he's got libertarian ideas and principles, but he seems to have a bit of a relationship with other entities who I think are very much opposed to equality, opposed to, well, in terms of us, Hobson's Pledge ideals. So while I can't say too much about it, I can say that I was quite shocked at it. I'm sure you can find it somewhere online if you were to hunt for it, but his rant was, in my opinion, unhinged and quite venomous. So it's appropriate that things have been done to stop the defamation and deception that goes on.
And one of the other big issues that Hobson's Pledge has been advocating on recently is the amendments to the Marine and Coastal Areas Amendment Bill. And what exactly is going on there with the foreshore and seabed? I believe that the courts have sort of tried to twist the current legislation into something it wasn't supposed to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have had quite a few activist judges, and this is actually going back even when you and I were quite in depth with New Conservatives, where we saw some activist judges engaging in what we would probably term as very criminal-friendly behavior, as in they were letting killers and molesters out or on home detention. This, I think, is one of those times in culture where the judges have again attempted some type of activism, where they're saying things such as tikanga must play a part in terms of the marine and coastal areas. And the setting up of rahui and wahitapu, these are areas that iwi are able to put in place around the country, and they already have in some cases, where they put a rahui in where you cannot go swimming, cannot engage in commercial fishing, cannot fish for your family. And so with the activist judges who are making decisions around the marine area and coastal areas, we have got to push the government to bring the ownership of that area back into the public, into the people of New Zealand. Because if you have a look at it, nearly the entirety of the coastline is under an attempt to put it effectively under the ownership of iwi. And this is not a good place to be, because we fully expect that you'll get people being segregated from the beach and kept away from the beach at different times. And we've already seen examples of that already.
And historically, customary marine title, being part of English law, can give local communities some sort of basically special fishing quotas and special fishing rights over areas that their ancestors have fished for generations and generations going back, to make sure that those people continue to have access to fish in their own area. But this is, as you're saying, this goes well beyond fishing rights.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. It's quite... if I might use the term, very much apartheid style ruling, meaning if you've got a certain skin color or if you fuck a papa back, if you've got a particular genealogy, then you suddenly have power and authority over someone who does not have the same genealogy. And that's inherently wrong, has never worked anywhere in the history of the world. New Zealand is for New Zealanders, and we should all have the right to go to any beach at any time that we want to. We should all be able to go fish for our families. We should be able to take our children, go for a walk along the beach. We shouldn't be kept away simply because our skin color, our bloodline, happens to be different than someone else's. It's utterly wrong at a deep level.
And on the whole, then, are you happy with the steps the government is taking to fix the problem that exists with the Marine and Coastal Area Act?
At the moment, it's okay, but there is a lot of devil in the detail style discussion to be had. Overall, it's okay. We would argue it's not far enough. We want to have race to be removed completely from. We think that the public should have ownership over those areas, that the people of New Zealand deserve to have, because we're New Zealand, no matter what your skin color is, no matter what your genealogy is. So at the moment, it looks much better than what it was before. We would advocate strongly for it to go further, to go into actual racial equality, not keep anything.
And on that subject as well, we've got the Treaty Principles Bill that David Seymour has put forward. And I've seen Don Brash complain about a nasty surprise in this Treaty Principles Bill. I remember asking you on Facebook a month or two ago now as well, what you thought about it, how Hobson's Pledge was going to respond to the Treaty Principles Bill, basically saying that the iwi should negotiate and hapu separately, potentially as well, should negotiate with the government over special treatment if that's what they want, but that the law should apply equally, everyone's got the same rights. But sometimes people can negotiate different kind of rights with the government. And that was something that you're concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely. Hobson's Pledge is a civil rights group. We are there for the equality of all people, that everyone should be treated as the same under the law. Now, the Treaty Principles Bill, as it shows so far, it looks good, but there are a couple of very big landmines in there. Because in one part, it does... not, I wouldn't say state, but the writing of it is that it will still seek to hold on to some of the race-based treatment, that some of the race-based treatment will remain. And that's a significant problem because, of course, what's the point? If you're trying to have an equal New Zealand for all New Zealanders, then that's opposed to what you're actually putting out there. Now, I can understand the pragmatism of it, which is to say that there have been legislated movements previous to this, even this government, around settlements and so forth. But if you're going to put out a Treaty Principles Bill, or if you're going to have a look at the Treaty of Waitangi, then we should be going back to that nice, clean element that we had back in 1840, which is, of course, the first article being of the cost, you know, that ceding of authority, the acceptance of the crown. Then part two, which is that property rights aspect, that what's mine is mine and yours is yours, and we can engage in trade over it. And of course, that third wonderful article where everyone is to be treated the same, that everyone is given the same rights and privileges as those under the British Empire at the time. So if we are going to have a discussion of it, we have to keep it clean, not muddy it, in my opinion, to not muddy it with, well, we're going to go back to what it was in 1840, but we're also going to leave in some of the race-based bits as well that we picked up along the way. My position is that we need to have equal rights for all New Zealanders, that we don't give extra power, we don't give extra stuff to someone, some group of people, simply because they've got a particular skin color. It's wrong. So we need to see a little bit more detail as to what's going on in this bill. So overall, it's okay. We just want to see a little bit more detail with it. But we are generally supportive of it as Hobson's Pledge. We just want to see a little bit more detail as well.
I guess the overall position is that it's better than the status quo. Sort of, it's an improvement at a minimum, maybe a step in the right direction. And really, you want to, well, if you're a purist about a particular subject, you want to get everything that you can out of it, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah. It's a lot better than what the 1975 bill, I guess it was put in good faith, but what's happened since is you've got the Waitangi Tribunal, which has just made extraordinary claims, and it's been even arguing about air being a taonga. And so, you know what, if you're doing a paragliding service, you need to be charged. If you're going down a river, you're doing some boat, well, we've got to placate the Taniwha who exists down there. Some of it is absolute nonsense. And so the Waitangi Tribunal is, I think, one of the worst things that we've had over the last, I would say, decade and a half, maybe two decades. I think there was a time where they were useful, but they have long, long since run out of purpose, and now it's just basically control. That's what it seems to be.
Yeah, I've discussed this with somebody else who basically made the good point saying that it's an industry around it, so they have to justify their existence. And that means that the problem, it's essentially if a government agency is set up to work on a particular problem, it can never fix that problem because it has to continually justify its own existence.
And I'll give you an example of how, in my scope, the Waitangi Tribunal, I think, is a direct threat to many of our institutions and mechanisms and our fixes for society. And one example I'll give you is this idea about prisons and prisoners who are currently in the correctional facilities. The Waitangi Tribunal, and I'm speaking very generally here, is the reason why there's so many Māori prisoners because of racism, colonialism, and effectively white people. And what that does is that, first off, that's highly inaccurate. That is not the highest pattern. The highest pattern is broken home upbringing. And while the Waitangi Tribunal is trying to push this, in that case, what that means is that millions and millions and millions of dollars, most of it taxpayer dollars, is going to fund those people who are seeking to decolonize things and try to attack white people, whatever that means, in terms of trying to fix the prison numbers. And at the same time, that's why we lose so much funding in those areas that seek to build up the family unit, to repair the family unit, to look after, you know, family overall. And so that the Waitangi Tribunal, in their attempt to engage in these race-baiting ideas, also has victims. And in this case, the victims are the future members of our Māori whānau who are going to end up in prison because they come from broken homes mostly. And that's a core reason, but not under the Waitangi Tribunal.
That's right. And most of the victims of crime are Māori as well. And so that means that if you're letting out more prisoners because of their race, then you're also going to create more victims based on their race, simply because most crimes sort of occur, tend to happen, not necessarily to strangers, but to people who know each other and are relatives. Unfortunately, that's where a lot of violent crime and so on occurs. And so
it's just basically a
spiral, like they will only get worse and worse. And they keep complaining about intergenerational violence and intergenerational trauma. Well, they're just about to, they're in the process of making it a whole lot worse.
Absolutely right. I will also totally agree with you about that whole industry aspect. There's a massive industry around grievance, and it's money and power. And if you have a look at, for example, the Mahuta expose, where we found that many different members of a family were right engaged in all of that grievance policy stuff, and then a huge amount of money and power has gone into her, what I would regard as an empire. Very strong, very powerful family, and it's almost entirely taxpayer funded as well.
And Tamahere is the same, where they're raking in the cash, and some investigations are happening there now. But yeah, as you said, they're just enriching their own families and at the expense of the rest of us.
At the expense of the rest of us, and those who they allege they are helping. Absolutely not. And I know that because I see the families every day. Well, most days I have discussions with my people who I've had in my past around the North Island. So I have a lot of ears out there who know very well what's going on. And so, you know, these other ones, their pockets are getting fat. They are living in mansions. I'm not joking. I'm not exaggerating about that. They are living in mansions. In the meantime, the rest of us are doing all we can. We're hustling so that we can have a decent life for us and our kids. It's absolutely wrong.
And one other issue that's getting worse is around universities, especially the law schools have to teach tikanga as part of a separate body of law that's apparently different to our settler colonial legal system. And I see that Hobson's Pledge has just basically uncovered that the University of Auckland is giving mandatory Treaty Waitangi courses, mandatory Māori history courses on all students. So it doesn't matter what subject you're studying, if you're studying engineering or art or whatever it might be, you have to do this mandatory treaty course. And I read through the details on this. It's interesting to me because I studied at Manukau Institute of Technology, and we actually had this probably close to 12 years ago, mandatory Treaty of Waitangi course for anyone, no matter what you were studying. And it's interesting to see that has spread to all these larger universities now. And I guess, on the whole, what's your thoughts on what's going on with that and what their aims are?
Yeah, so again, I think it's one of those indoctrination elements, because we don't push for other courses to, I'm trying to think of an equivalent, you know, to go over there and learn about, I don't know, whatever they say, white people, colonial lessons. We don't do that. It's only tikanga. Now, first off, it's not fit for purpose, because you're there to do a lot of study. If you're at university, you're paying out thousands and thousands of dollars in order to gain the education for your course of or that outcome that you want. And so if you're talking about computer usage, coding practices, what on earth does learning tikanga have to do with any of that? Does it make any sense whatsoever? I will say that I've got quite a nice full heart, because we learn of these issues because so many more people over the last year or so, we've heard from these people for years, but over the last year, we've had so many people now contacting us, advising us of the struggles that they're having, that they're really finding it tough, and it's because of these issues. Now, why I'm quite happy about that in a way is it means that it's no longer being, you know, the fear element that the university academic wokes are trying to inculcate to people, the chilling effect, the fear factor of you can't say anything, you're not allowed to say anything, you have to shut up and you just have to grin and bear it. It's no longer making them so fearful that they can't even speak to others quietly. Now we're getting contacted by many, many different people who are giving us direct examples of what they're having to put up with. And I feel good about that, because at least it means that we're a trusted place. We won't throw them under the bus. And at the same time, we are taking the fight up for them. And we absolutely love that. I will say, as well as that, with tikanga, is it's quite offensive to say, oh, well, you're going to learn tikanga, because you're absolutely right. That is tikanga that they label it as. The problem is that iwi have very different ideas of tikanga. Tikanga is a very localized event for the different regions of Māori. That's why, for example, I will say that my blood is Te Atawa Ngāti Raukawa, that I was raised up in an area which is in Ōtaki. But the learnings, the tikanga that I learned was Tainui. Now, there are some massive differences. In some marae, if you do not take your shoes off, you'll be beaten up and chucked out the door. In some marae, if you are supposed to wear your shoes on when you go into the marae. Some, they separate the men and the women. Some, they mix it up on purpose. Some, the manuhiri tikanga is localized a different area. So then you've got to think, who is arrogant enough to be sitting there going, oh, you're going to learn what I view as tikanga and tau Māori and all these other little woke words that they want to use. It's quite despicable, and it weakens not just the education of the students who are going to it, but it also weakens the idea of individuality within Māoridom. It's saying, well, my idea of tikanga is everyone else, no matter whether you're from the south or the north, you will learn under what we tell you to learn. And, you know, not just wrong, but it's crazy. It's creating division between the races as well.
I'm just casting my mind back to when I was at university doing these courses. We had to do ethics, and most people would turn up for that. And then it was the Treaty of Waitangi was being covered. Then I turn up to class for the Treaty of Waitangi. There's 28 students in the class, I think just shy of 30. Turn up to the class. There are three students in the class who turned up for the Treaty of Waitangi. And I came from a private school, didn't really know much about all of this controversy around the Treaty of Waitangi. And I'm asking some of these other students, I'm saying, why does nobody turn up to the Treaty of Waitangi class? And they said, we've heard so much of it. High school, they won't stop. You know, they go on and on about it. We're so sick of this. We're so sick of this Treaty of Waitangi, this. And going through that course on the Treaty of Waitangi was quite eye-opening for me. It was just, you know, bashing the missionaries, bashing the government. And that was an aspect of politics in New Zealand that I wasn't familiar with at that time. The thing that I really, really noticed was how much the students hated it, how much they avoided it. And you had ones, even the Maori ones, were sort of like, oh, I'm sort of ashamed of all of this stuff. You know, they were ashamed of it. And I thought, oh, this is terrible. I hope it'll go away. And we see now, 10 years later, it's only getting worse. And I think that students have is probably grown stronger.
Well, I was lucky. I went to a Catholic school, and the Catholic school I went to was very much fact-based. So they didn't take a political position in it. They were very fact-based. It was the good, the bad, and the ugly, but they didn't hide anything, and they spoke about it in very plain terms. So I was actually quite fortunate. I didn't realize how falsified much of the history had been conducted until maybe about 10-ish years ago when I started to really engage in some of the, what do they call it, SIFs, but then it turned to Oranga Tamariki, started seeing the state departments and how they've very much fabricated and angled a lot of those lessons and those teachings. So it can be a positive. Learning about the Treaty of Waitangi, I think, is a good thing, but not in the fictionalized, reformed, redefined style that we see in most of our schools today.
And as I said, that's why the students hate it. They just know that it's a whinge session, basically, for the teacher or the lecturer to go and talk about how bad the government is and how bad this person is and that person is. And there's no positive vision of it at all. It's very, very terrible.
Yep, absolutely right. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, any last thoughts now on how the government are doing? Because we're running out of time. Thank you very much for joining me. But I'll give you a last word. Tell us, what do you think of the current government, and any encouragement for people to follow your work as well?
Yeah, so I'm overall quite happy with the government. They are making a pragmatic stance. They're doing what they said they were going to do. They've got their plan, and they have been ticking off as they go through it. They've been transparent in telling us as they do go through, which is just an incredibly marked difference from the last government. So I am overall quite happy with that. I would like some improvements done in terms of bringing New Zealand back to an equal place, as we treat all people the same. But on the whole, much, much happier than I have been for many years in terms of government. In terms of Hobson's Pledge, we are very excited. We're having a great time at the moment, and a lot of it is because we are getting so many people jumping on board, and they are really wanting to contribute. They really want us to push hard. We've got discussions every time I go out of Auckland. I've got meetup being requested wherever I go. It's really awesome. It's really exciting. And I just love the fact that Kiwis are pushing back on this racist status quo that we've had for years. And we are more than happy to be the vanguard, to be that force to step forward and to take those hits so that all of our people may stand up and, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, to be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin.
Well, thank you very much for joining me, Elliot. And Hobson's Pledge and Elliot are both available on basically every social media platform, so you can go and find their work there. And they also do email newsletters as well if you go through for their website and sign up for those. And to all of our listeners, please stick around and we will be right back after this. Thank you, Elliot.
Cheers, mate.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
Taking part in conversations and discussions to help find resolutions for the issues of today. This is The Dialogue with Diwa Dabor.
We have some time now for a bit of an extended look into what the week ahead looked like in New Zealand history. Tomorrow, the 15th of October, was a very busy day in New Zealand history. In 1877, former Governor George Grey became Premier. Sir George Grey was the dominant figure in 19th century New Zealand politics, and one of New Zealand's key founding fathers. He served two terms as governor before becoming premier. He was a Gladstonian liberal, and to understand Grey, I think, is to understand much of New Zealand and Kiwi culture as it exists today. He initially opposed elected representation for the settler minority, feeling that his benevolent dictatorship was far better for the fledgling colony, and I think we can probably agree that he was right. But 6 years later, the situation had changed, and he was the chief author of the first constitution that created provincial and central representative assemblies. He certainly favoured provincialism, which unfortunately was a feature of New Zealand politics that did not survive. It was crushed quite quickly by the centralization of Julius Vogel, one of Gray's successors. Other elements of Gray's liberal advocacy, however, did survive. One man, one vote. In 1942, still on the 15th of October, New Zealand coast watchers were executed by the Japanese on the Gilbert Islands, now Kiribati. Being a coast watcher was usually a boring and isolated job, keeping an eye on passing ships and other activity, radio transmissions and so on. But the risks on the Gilbert Islands were very real. All those executed received a posthumous mention in dispatches, and the civilians were retrospectively given military rank in 1944 so that their dependents could claim pensions and other rights. There was not much of a battle there on the Gilbert Islands, but after I finish this history segment, I will go over the bloodiest island battle of that war, Iwo Jima. Now, in 2007, still on the 15th of October, extensive anti-terror raids were carried out by police in the Urawaras. Under the Terrorism Suppression Act, 18 people were arrested in a number of raids linked to weapons training camps in the Bay of Plenty. Among those arrested was Ngātuhoe activist Tame Iti. Police said Iti was involved in running military-style training camps in the Urawera Ranges and was planning to establish an independent state on Tuhoe land. Four of those arrested were brought to trial and convicted on illegal weapons charges, and Te Iti went to prison for 2.5 years. Moving forward to Wednesday, the 19th of October, it will be the anniversary of Jean Batten reaching Auckland after her solo flight in 1936. Her plane still hangs in the international airport. And out of pure coincidence, I'll be getting on a flight that day. Batten had left Kent in England on the 5th of October, and her journey, solo flight to New Zealand, had taken a total of 11 days and 45 minutes. Now, on the 17th of October, 1877, something thematic for the issues we've been discussing today, Chief Justice Sir James Prendergast declared the Treaty of Waitangi was a worthless, simple nullity. The case involved a block of land given to the Anglican Church on the understanding that a school would be built on it, but no such school was built. Prendergast ruled the courts lacked the ability to consider claims based on a native title. The Treaty of Waitangi was worthless because it had been signed, and I quote, between a civilized nation and a group of savages who were not capable of signing a treaty. And since the treaty practically had not been incorporated into domestic law, it was a simple nullity. This is not to say, I think, people have misinterpreted what he said, that the Treaty of Waitangi is completely irrelevant. His ruling was based on earlier Court of Appeals decisions, and claims on the basis of the treaty, or any treaty for that matter, cannot be brought to court for the very reason that these are not part of our domestic laws. Obviously, that seems to be something that basically the contention, the political issues today around the treaty are sort of around circumventing this problem that has existed for 150 years. And instead of coming up with solutions that are, you know, political solutions, legal solutions that are unrelated to the treaty, we seem to be stuck in a little bit of a negative feedback loop where everything comes back to the treaty when in reality is, as far as the law is concerned in claims in court, it's simply something that cannot be dealt with. Well, that's all for this week in New Zealand history. We will now go on to look at the battle that I promised. And as usual, it will be adapted from Nigel Cawthorne's Masterstrokes of War. And last week we looked at Kursk. And now we'll go a little bit forward to the end of the war, 1945. While the war raged in Europe, the American forces were island hopping across the Pacific. They were still fighting in the Philippines and Borneo when plans were created for this invasion of Japan. The planners decided this would come with landings on Kyushu, the most southerly of the Japanese islands. And so in the closing months of 1944, the B-29 superfortresses that were stationed on the Mariana Islands under General LeMay began a campaign of bombing, but it was a round trip of 3,000 miles from Saipan to mainland Japan, a long flight even for the superfortresses. However, if the US forces could take this little volcanic island of Iwo Jima in the Bonin Islands, which lay some mere 800 miles to the south of Japan, they would halve the distance to Tokyo with fighter station there. The US Air Force would be able to defend its bombers over their targets. And Iwo Jima was doubly important because Japan considered the island to be its unsinkable aircraft carrier. It was a radar and fighter base whose aircraft intercepted the superfortresses on their bombing missions over Japan. Irregularly shaped, Iwo Jima is about 5 miles long and only half as wide in its thickest place. The Japanese were determined to hold on to it. They had garrisoned the island with 21,000 troops, and it had the strongest defenses of all the Japanese possessions in the Pacific. It had been under constant bombardment since the fall of the Marianas in July, but the prolonged fighting in the Philippines had delayed the attack, giving the Japanese a few months to build up the island's already formidable fortifications. As on other Pacific islands, they had created underground defenses, making the best possible use of natural caves and the rocky terrain. For days before the landings, Iwo Jima was subjected to massive bombardment by naval guns, rockets, and airstrikes using bombs carrying recently developed napalm. But the Japanese were so well dug in that no amount of shelling or bombing could knock them out. And so on the 19th of February, the 5th Amphibious Corps under General Harry Schmidt went ashore on the south of the island. And just as an aside, I think every general that fought for every single army on World War II was basically a German or had a German last name. Schmidt confidently predicted that he could take the island in 4 days, but it was not going to be that easy. In fact, it was going to be the most costly battle in US Marine Corps history. The first wave of Marines crossed the beach, which was just 200 yards wide. They were caught in a savage crossfire and were pounded with mortars fired from pits just a few feet wide. Flamethrowers, explosives, and tanks were needed to clear them. Of the 30,000 men who landed on the beaches of the first day, 2,500 were hit by the Japanese. The Marines soon had a 4,000-yard-long beachhead, but they could only move slowly inland because of the island's ashy volcanic soil. The 5th Marines then divided their forces. Half struck inland and took the first to the Japanese airfields. The 3rd airfield was under construction. The other half turned south to take the mount. Such was the strength of these Japanese positions that it was not until the 3rd day the mount was fully surrounded. The next morning, the 28th Marines occupied 200 yards of the lower slopes. Planes then pounded the Japanese positions. On the 23rd of February, the F Company of the 2nd Battalion came back from patrol and reported that the Japanese had gone to ground. A larger patrol under Lieutenant Schreier eventually reached the crater and took the summit after a brisk firefight. The raising of the American flag by 6 Marines on the mount was photographed by Joe Rosenthal of the Associated Press. It became one of the best-known images of the Pacific War, and statues, painting, and American postage stamp designs have been based on it. The photograph actually depicts the second flag being raised. The first had been raised some hours earlier, but it was too small to be seen by the other troops on the island, and a bigger one, borrowed from a ship, was substituted for propaganda purposes. When the 5th Marines moved up the west coast, the 4th found their way up the east coast. Despite a naval bombardment, airstrikes, and fire from marine artillery, the 4th was stopped by mines and anti-tank guns. The 5th managed to take some of the Japanese emplacements under heavy fire and had advanced by about 500 yards at the end of the first day. The fighting was so intense that the 3rd Marines, the floating reserve, needed to be landed. They were to take the Northern Plateau, a strange lunar landscape that had been eroded into weird shapes by wind and rain. was perfect defensive terrain for the determined Japanese force, and flame-throwing tanks had to be brought up to incinerate them in the shell-proofed bunkers. Eventually, the Marines achieved the capture of all the hills overlooking the 3rd Airstrip, and by the 28th of February, all three airfields were in American hands. The Marines had achieved their objective, but the fighting was far from over. They went on to attack Hill 382 and Hill 362A. Both hills were warrens of bunkers and tunnels. The crest of Hill 382 had been hollowed out to make a huge bunker that housed anti-tank guns, and tanks were hidden in the gullies. To the south, there was a natural bowl that had been named the Amphitheater by the Marines, and a huge rock that was known as the Turkey Knob. Marine casualties were so high in that area that these features were jointly known as the Meat Grinder. Marines abandoned their normal practice and attacked at night, and they attempted to capture the complex. Even though they took the enemy by surprise, it took 6 days to take the position. It was not until the 8th of March that the Japanese counterattacked, but the attack was over open ground, with no artillery support, and they pulled back, leaving 650 dead. The Marines continued up the center of the island. By the 9th of March, they had reached the northern east coast. On the 15th of March, the Japanese made a number of attempts to infiltrate the American lines, but were pushed back. The last pocket of resistance at the northern tip of the island was reported secure on the 25th of March. However, the following day, some 350 Japanese emerged from the blackened rocks. It is said they were led by the general himself. They charged into the bivouac area where the men of the 5th Pioneer Battalion were sleeping. A hasty defensive line was set up, and by sunrise, some 223 Japanese lay dead. After that, all resistance collapsed. Over 20,000 Japanese had been killed, and only 261 were taken prisoner. The Marines and the Army lost 6,812 of their number, and a further 19,189 were wounded. However, the lives of some 24,761 American pilots and aircrew were saved by using Iwo Jima as a forward airbase. The Battle of Iwo Jima produced a costly but decisive victory, and now the all-out assault on the Japanese mainland could begin. And in the next 5 months, over 2,000 superfortresses flew bombing missions from the airfields of Iwo Jima. However, the scale of the recent fighting had left the Americans with a worrying question. If the Japanese fought so ferociously for an island of just 8 square miles, which they had only gained in 1891, what sort of resistance would the Americans face when they landed on the main islands of Japan itself? And, well, you know the rest of the story, don't you? Now, we will go on to William McGimpsey. But first, let's listen to another piano piece, this time by contemporary Italian composer Ludovico Einaudi. And this piece, played by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, is called Primavera. Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the dialogue with Dewey de Boer and William McGimpsey for Reality Check Radio, where we take a look back at last week's event and a little bit of a retrospective, or as has been suggested, we may call it Monday's Moot Points. And welcome back to the show, William.
Thanks, Dewa. Good to be here again.
I appreciate it. And I've mentioned it already on the show, but I'll be away for roughly a month. So this may be the last roundup for the next little while, unless some kind of alternative host is found for it, but we'll see how that goes. So we'll make the most of this week, and we'll get right into the first issue, and I'll make it a domestic issue, not an international issue, and that is going to be around the census data, because you yourself have made quite a bit of commentary on the census data that was released, I believe, last Friday, but just over a week ago, so about 9 days now, and they released a data tool, and we haven't really talked about that yet, but it's taken some time for people to go looking through a lot of the elements of demographic data that census have revealed from the 2023 census, which was a little bit of a botched census. They had a lot of missing data, low response rates, and they tried to massage that data. And then it's taken them over a year, year and a half, to get the data back to people. And I think, as you have been saying, that there are still a lot of odd things about the census data.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's two issues with the census. The first is there's a lot of funny things, things that have been botched. I mean, that it's been a bit of a train wreck from start to finish, really. And the second thing is that the census reveals the extent and pace of the demographic changes that are going on in New Zealand as a result of the high immigration rates. So it reveals how quickly and how profoundly the Great Replacement is progressing in New Zealand. So just quickly, if you ignore the ethnicity stats, the headline stats that Stats New Zealand has put out, and you dig into the data for yourself, into the Data Explorer, you can see that the New Zealand European population is down to 55.9% of the population. The Maori population is 7.3%. The mixed Maori and European population is 8.2%. And then you've got 15.7% Asian, 5.5% Pacific Islander, and 7.4% other. So that's quite low, 55.9% for Europeans. And that suggests that, you know, if the rates of immigration we've been experiencing in recent year or two continue, over 200,000 a year, and also if the rates of New Zealand citizens leaving that are quite high at the moment, if that continues, there's a real chance that by the time the next census comes around, that European New Zealanders could be in an absolute minority, below 50% in New Zealand. Now, lots of things can change. It may not happen. It may take more time than that, but that's something that could happen. Mm-hmm. The other thing to note here with the Maori numbers, like Stats New Zealand are making a big effort about to inflate the Maori category as much as possible. So in the figures that they have produced in their media release, they say New Zealand European are 62.1%, Maori are 17.8%, Indian are 5.8%, Chinese 5.6%, Samoan 4.3%, and then there's some other groups as you go down there. So 17.8% is a very large number of Maori. In the figures I've
produced, add all those numbers up, does that add up to well over 100 as well? Or are they?
Yeah, that adds up to 106.8%.
Yeah. Their maths is not the strong point of Stats New Zealand, is it?
No, they specialize in other things. But yeah, the reason for that is they're double counting the categories, I think. I think that's why they're doing it. So for example, if you're part Maori and part European and you tick both boxes, then rather than just putting you into a mixed Maori-European category, they're sort of adding you to both categories. And then when you do that, the total sums to more than 100. But the funny thing is there's more mixed people than the... So the total it adds to on their data is 106.8%, but there's more than 6.8% mixed. So they're doing something strange where they're not applying exactly the same rules to all groups, unless I've got that wrong somehow. So this,
I think you do have that right, because I ran some of my own calculations that were published on goodoil.news the previous week, and you can find that on rightminds.nz as of Saturday. But I did a calculation where I kind of said, well, what if we prioritize those identifying as New Zealand, as European New Zealand, into kind of a New Zealander ethnicity? And you got that 56% Europeans, you say, 8% Anglo-Maori, so European Maori, and 4% other mixed European of some kind to get 68%. But basically, if you look at what they're doing with calculating the Maori electorates, you get 7% Maori and add another 10% when they, so 7% saying that they're exclusively Maori. And that 10%, it comes from basically that 8% that are European Maori and then another 2% that are Maori, Pacific Islander, Maori, Asian kind of mix. So for the purposes of calculating the numbers of Maori for the electoral calculation, where they determine how many Maori seats there are, they're exclusively counting them that way. So that's where you get those extra numbers from, where they're selectively double counting them depending on what the purposes of the stats they're providing you with.
Yeah, it's not as simple. It's not. This, we kind of said this before, just to reiterate. I don't think they're applying a blanket rule of double counting for everyone. They're selectively doing it for certain groups, or at least that is what it appears. They really need to come out and confirm what they're doing there, because that doesn't seem credible from a statistics department to be doing that. That seems just making up your own statistics to prove whatever point you want to prove.
Well, we actually discussed this a number of months ago, you know, before we had the actual raw figures from the census, because it was Elizabeth Rata, I believe, who wrote an explainer sort of on how they calculate Maori electorates and how they kind of came up to their 1 million Maori.
Was that Muriel Newman, you mean?
You might be right, and I could just be misremembering. But and it seems like now that we have the raw numbers, you can sort of guess more so at what they're doing, but still very, very strange from stats, as you say. And they refuse to come out and tell you exactly what it is they're doing to fudge the numbers.
Yeah, yeah. And the ethnicity data isn't the only funny thing that's gone on with the census. If you remember right back to the beginning, there was a big hoopla about the they included the gender questions. So the census actually had questions about your biological sex and about your gender and about all this other sexuality stuff as well. So I think there are four questions related to that. And that's really buying into quite a radical ideological view of sex and gender that most people don't share. Most people, I think that you can be a man or a woman based on biology, and then there are mentally ill people who are confused about it. And what Stats New Zealand are saying is, oh, no, we're going to legitimize what was previously thought of as a mental illness and create this new thing called a gender identity, which apparently everyone has that they didn't know they had. And you've got to tick the box and tell people what it is. So that's a highly ideological view, and it just sort of brings the census into disrepute. A lot of people disagree with that. Then there's the question of, did they get enough responses to make it credible? So for a census to be credible, the idea is you survey basically everyone, or as close to everyone as you can in the country, and to figure out who they all are. They set a target of achieving only 90%, which is still quite low. That's 1 in 10 people not filling it out. And they only got 88.3 or something like that. So they didn't even meet their already quite low target. And this is with people running around to people's houses, offering them, you know, KFC vouchers and Warriors tickets if they'd fill in the forms. So that, that didn't work. They still couldn't make it up to the 90% target, even doing that. And then,
This is one of the reasons they don't release iwi data. So you don't get breakdowns for how large each iwi is, because they say, oh, the response rates were too low for us to provide you with this data.
Not credible. And then there was the issue with Manurewa Marae. If you remember, there's a great big scandal about that, and they've got a sprawling investigation into several government departments going on as a result of what happened there. But with the census data part of it, it looks like what has happened is Stats New Zealand has gone into, done a deal with Manurewa Marae to help them gather the stats information, so go out to people's homes and encourage them to fill in the forms. But the suspicion is that the people at Manurewa Marae have peeked into the data and found out people's addresses and phone numbers and if they're Maori or not, and then use that information for electioneering to go and target them and talk them into voting for the Maori Party or voting for Tash Kemp, who worked at Manurewa Marae.
And she won by 100 and something votes, right? So very small margins.
So that could have made a big difference, that electioneering. Now, that's still being investigated, but I think that is the suspicion about what has happened there. But a number of other dodgy things happened at Manurewa Marae as well. It's not just that. So you can see there's a sort of long-running train wreck that's been going on with the census. And next time they're talking about not even really doing a census next time. They're going to fill in the administrative data, fill in the census information using data they have from other sources, administrative data, they call it. And so that raises, a number of other questions. If we're not actually going to be surveying people, there's some credibility issues that come in.
Well, if you already have no credibility when you're actually surveying people, how much credibility are you going to have when you stop surveying people and just claim to have the secret data that you've gathered from the other government departments? And then, obviously there's an incentive sometimes, especially when it comes to the ethnicity data, to fudge the figures.
Yeah. And you can see there's a pattern that's happening in other countries. It's happening in Australia, where they're putting all the emphasis on the LGBTQ and the sexuality and the gender identity and putting more questions into the census around that. And they're trying to fudge and take out questions around the ethnicity data and make it harder to actually figure out what's going on. So that's something I think they're probably going to try and pull in a number of countries.
The bureaucracy loves talking about how great and wonderful multiculturalism is and how much they love multiculturalism. But then when you want to find out exactly just how multicultural the country is, then suddenly, hang on a minute, you're asking too many questions.
Yeah, no, we don't want to do that sort of thing. So anyway, that's I think that's my summary of most of what's going on with the census there. It's there's a huge ethnic replacement going on, a huge demographic change, and they've botched the census, and it's very hard to figure out, at least from their headline data, what's going on. Although some of the underlying data in the tables provided still seems as if it's pretty good. So,
and this should concern people, and I've written this in my column for Good Oil and on Right Minds NZ. This should concern people because you've got a lot of institutional bias. Universities, public servants with a lot of anti-white rhetoric, and you're wondering, well, what direction is this country going? And especially if white people were to become a minority in this country, European New Zealanders become a minority, especially when there's institutional bias, what is that going to look like? What is the future going to look like for your children if the country ends up in that shape? And also massive encouragement from these institutions for people to engage in multiculturalism, which is, you know, people seeking their own ethnic interests as a priority, as a political thing. And I go into how we have MPs who say that they represent particular ethnic communities. So we have the example that I use is Paulo Garcia, a National Party MP, quite a conservative guy, but he's talking about how he represents the Filipino community in New Zealand and how great it is the Filipino community is growing, how the Filipino language is increasing in New Zealand more and more. Filipino is being spoken, or Tagalog, I think is the name of the language, sorry, and how their influence is only getting stronger. And he very specifically talks about that as the interest of that particular ethnic community. You've got the same for the Chinese, for the Indians, and so on. It's, not singling him out in particular. And so obviously we have the Maori Party talking about how they represent Maori MPs. You've got Pacific Islanders who talk about how they represent Pacific Island communities. So there's a rapid reorganization of New Zealand politics along ethnic lines, and that's part of the electoral strategies of these parties. They're pretty open about it as well. And so, of course, then the question becomes, okay, well, what about European New Zealanders? What about the old stock New Zealanders, the descendants of the settlers and so on? What about their ethnic interests? Are they allowed to have MPs who talk about their ethnic interests? Well, we already know the answer to that is no, that's not allowed. But there are very serious questions that New Zealanders should be asking about what direction their country is being pushed in. And then a question that we need to answer is, well, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah. And I think it's inevitable that identity politics is an effective political organizing strategy. The groups that do identity politics tend to get their way more than the groups that don't. And so that creates a dynamic where if people want to be effective in their political organizing, they're going to be naturally pushed towards doing identity politics. And that goes for white New Zealanders and white everyone else and all other Western countries too. So that
it's no longer a question of, well, is it good or bad? It's the question of, well, it's happening. What are we doing? What are we doing? We're well past that stage where you can be, you know, the discussion of whether it's good or bad. The reality is it's happening and it's only getting stronger.
And when we had more homogenous, more ethnically homogenous states, the government and most of the public institutions were de facto charged with looking after the interests of the homogenous ethnic group in the country. And so as these other ethnic groups have come in under, you know, diversity and multiculturalism, the government has tried to take a sort of neutral stance between the interests of these competing groups. And what that means is that the ethnic majority who used to be, you know, it used to be their government who looked out for them. And now they don't have a big institution like a government and these other institutions looking out for their interests. And so then the natural impulse is to create institutions again that will look after their interests, that will solve those collective action problems that are needed to provide for the interests of that group of people. If you take away the institution that used to do that, naturally there's a vacuum there that will be filled by people trying to create another institution to do the thing that the old institution used to do. And that's really where we're at.
I've got two international issues here that are somewhat tangential to that point that you've just made. One of them being in America and the other being in Australia, one being a free speech issue and the other one being related to, I guess, certain interests being ignored. And we may start with that one in America, where you've had a lot of flooding recently, especially in some of these swing states, Georgia, North Carolina, Florida being hit by a hurricane as well. And there have been some big issues with the federal response, where basically, again, comparing this, the federal government has no issue providing billions of dollars to Ukraine, has no problem providing billions of dollars to Israel, has no problem providing billions of dollars to get hundreds of thousands of Haitians out of Haiti and bring them into America. But then as soon as there's this massive disaster in these rural states, these redneck areas, then suddenly there seems to be a total complete breakdown of the government. You've got the president, the vice president saying, oh, we've offered everything that we can do. It's too hard. We've given all that we can. These are supposed to be their people. That's the response that we've done all that we can. But when it comes to helping other people around the world, suddenly they seem to be able to come up with billions of dollars. When it's their own people in these rural swing state areas, then suddenly these rednecks and these backwaters, then suddenly the flooding, natural disasters, too bad, you're out of luck.
Yeah, well, they're clearly capable of getting the resources together and providing the funds, if they have sufficient motivation to do so. They just don't want to do it. And I think this goes to an important point, that society works because people have certain ethical and moral commitments, certain things that they feel obliged, morally obliged to do. And one of those things in the past has always been this sense that a leader's job is to look out for the people that they represent. And it seems as if the leaders in America currently, many of the political leaders at least, no longer feel that political obligation or that moral obligation. And so they're not doing it. They think the money is better spent elsewhere on these, you know, these international aid packages, fighting foreign wars. So that's what we've got. They're also going as far, I mean, there's been rumors about people flying their own rescue missions in helicopters, and they've been told that they're not allowed to do that or they're going to be arrested. There's a whole lot of things going on, not just to not give them money, but to actively make it harder for rescue efforts and things like that to go on in these areas. And that's just abominable, really.
The good news, at least for many of these rural Americans, is they are quite resourceful. Many of their fellow countrymen have, as you've already pointed out, have put help together and are bringing it in as fast as they can, in spite of the federal government trying to slow them down, to stop them. So the situation there will get cleared up, hopefully in time for the election, so that all those people get to vote. And because I think at this point, that kind of response from the federal government is going to influence your vote somewhat. Quickly, any developments that you'd like to raise with regards to the US election? I know this is the last time, at least on the weekly roundup, that you'll get to do so, because there won't be any until after the election is over. The next weekly roundup will have a sort of a retrospective on the election. So we've both made our predictions and that we think Trump is going to win. I think so as well. It's clear that especially Elon Musk is putting all his chips down behind Trump as well, and seems to be quite confident, saying this is it, this is the last election. He calls it the last election, the final election, because if Trump loses, then it's over. Kamala will amnesty so many illegals that and make them citizens that they that no Republican could ever win an election again. So Elon Musk says it's the only important election, the final election.
Yeah, well, the most recent developments are Trump's triumphant, I guess. You could say, return to Butler, Pennsylvania, the site of the failed assassination attempt, where he was joined by Elon Musk, and also his running mate, J.D. Vance, I think, was there as well. And he resumed his speech from where he left off, and he started off his speech with, as I was saying, you know, hinting to the fact that he was rudely interrupted last time he was there. So there's something to that. There's something stirring about that, I think. And on the Kamala Harris side, she's recently done an interview with CNN, where she doesn't often do well in interviews, and she didn't do well in this interview. So she was asked questions about the why she opened up the southern border and there was a terrible response. And it looks like, actually, there's some indication that CNN has gone through and, recognizing that her response to that question was so terrible, has edited the response and like pasted in an answer that she gave earlier in the interview into that one to cover up her awful answer. So that's what appears to be happening there.
I listened to parts of that interview, and there were so many wonderful Kamala-isms in that interview where you can do it better than I can, but she talks about how the thing, you know, this thing is because that thing. And so the thing, yeah, just a wonderful way of speaking that she has.
What can be unburdened by what has been.
And we will move now very briefly to Australia as well. And this issue is tangential to kind of multiculturalism, in that there was a law passed in Victoria, I think maybe last year, basically making the Nazi salute illegal. I say basically, I mean, it added a penalty for making a Nazi salute of $23,000 or 12 months in jail. And there was a guy there who is a Nazi. He says he's an actual Nazi. He believes in Nazism, who went and did a Nazi salute in front of a courthouse. His name is Jacob Hersant, and he's been convicted, and it'll be tomorrow that he'll be sentenced, and the judge has already indicated that he's going to jail. So quite a serious issue, I think, in terms of political expression. You say, like, okay, Nazism is not a nice thing for people to believe, but we're supposed to be a free country, and we're supposed to have democracy and freedom of expression. Somebody who is expressing a political belief shouldn't be going to jail.
That's right. A Nazi salute isn't violence. A Nazi salute is just a form of political expression or philosophical expression or some sort of free expression. And a lot of people don't like it, but there's a lot of things you can do that people don't like. You can give people the fingers. You can do all sorts of things that are offensive and distasteful. And you ought to be able to do those things without going to jail, and you ought to be able to give Nazi salutes without going to jail too.
So I looked at the interview that he did with journalists outside the court. This guy himself, what's his name, Jacob Hersant, he looks very well presented, looks like a normal guy. You know, you're thinking like skinhead, tattoos or whatever. No, he looks like a regular guy with some very strange political beliefs. And he did an interview with the media where they said, well, you harmed minority groups. And he asks, how does political expression harm minority groups? And they said, well, the court has ruled that it harms minority groups. And there are people who would feel hurt by what you did. So that's basically the level of reasoning going on in Victoria, Australia. And this seems to be, it's happening in Victoria now, but this is what these people implementing these laws in Victoria want to do in all of Australia. They want to do this in New Zealand as well. Basically say, you did something, you said something, and there were some minority groups that felt hurt by what you said or what you did, and now you need to go to prison.
Yeah.
And his response, I'm just going for a bit, for his response was as well, was to say, well, I'm offended by, like, say, okay, he said, oh, Jews made it illegal for him to do this, and he's offended by what the Jews write in the Talmud, he's offended by the Talmud, kind of flipping the argument over. But you could flip this over onto anybody. I think I see here in the transcript, he cites the Liberal Party as well. So some people are offended by the Liberal Party, you know, but the Liberal Party is obviously allowed to have people offended at it, people hurt by it. You could say the same in New Zealand today, the coalition government, you've got people who say that they're being oppressed by laws that are being passed by the New Zealand government at the moment, that they feel hurt by things that the opinions of the New Zealand government. This is a completely absurd standard that's being applied here in Victoria. And you can see just how these journalists fall in line to say, to like enforce what the regime wants them to silence. There's no journalists who are saying, hang on a minute, we're putting somebody in jail for political expression, like completely peaceful public political expression, even though it may be abhorrent or people may dislike it or feel hurt by it. And the journalists are more than happy to see him thrown in jail.
Yeah, I mean, they're not principled defenders of free speech or what we used to call liberalism, even. They're using words, using laws, they're using the legal system to put people who say things they disagree with in jail. That's wrong. And it's not just wrong according to my way of thinking, according to my ideology. That's wrong according to what is ostensibly the ruling liberal ideology. Like our governments and our institutions are being hypocritical. They're not living up to their own professed ethical standards and frameworks in this respect.
And I guess we could just highlight that obviously the laws like this don't actually seem to work, because it seems like instead of people saying, oh, look, there are no more Nazis in Victoria, that someone's willing to say, yeah, I believe in Nazism and go to prison for it in Victoria, which is quite an extraordinary thing in and of itself.
Well, he's got a lot of publicity. It's even kind of sympathetic because all he's done is give a Hitler salute. He hasn't hurt anyone. He hasn't assaulted anyone. He is actually the victim. And so the people who are doing this are kind of, if anything, it's probably going to backfire.
I would agree with you there. And going back to what we were talking about earlier about multiculturalism, it seems to be the driving force here. When you look at the arguments that are made for these kind of laws, is to say, well, because we're multicultural now, we have to make certain things illegal so you don't offend the other groups. Essentially, we need a stronger state. We need more restrictions on freedom. We need more restrictions on speech, political expression, because we now have so many different minority groups that might be offended and maybe they'll get violent, and we'll basically need a police state to enforce multiculturalism. And this is, I think, a classic example of, if you have multiculturalism, you're going to need a police state to enforce it.
Yeah, yeah. Those things seem to have gone together. You'll notice that the push for speech restrictions are coming from the same people who are pushing for multiculturalism and diversity and equity and inclusion. That hate speech laws and laws against misinformation and this sort of stuff seem to be part of the same package that goes with the diversity, equity, and inclusion ideology. And that's what that's doing, is it's driving a wedge between what used to be two groups who were kind of allied, the classical liberals, the liberal people, and the more progressive DEI people. Free speech, freedom of association, certain of these freedoms, they are on the liberal side, but they're disagreed with by the DEI side of this alliance. And so it's driving those two apart.
Now, speaking of the DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, we'll just go on to something completely unrelated, actually. The HMS Mana Wainui, New Zealand Navy ship that sunk off the coast of Samoa, I believe. And we still haven't got the results of why it sank, so we're speculating here. But there were a lot of jokes after the ship was sunk that it had to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion. You made a funny, unrelated tweet about spatial intelligence as well. Spatial reasoning. I can't quite remember exactly what that was. But maybe you can explain a little bit about what exactly is going on here with people talking about DEI in connection with one of our ships being sunk. Not that that was the reason it sunk, but why it's become a discussion point.
Well, before I repeat my sexist comment, I'd just like to say that I love women, and I have great relationships with women and many, many friends in the female community. So, but look, men and women are different, and even the feminists agree with me about that now, and that's part of their argument against why the trans people shouldn't be allowed in the women's toilets and why the trans people shouldn't be allowed to play in the women's sports department, because there are biological differences between men and women. And all I'm saying is that there are other biological differences between men and women too, and they relate to the way our brains work. And one that's well established in the scientific literature is around spatial intelligence. So women are not less intelligent than men on average. Women are, if anything, very slightly more intelligent than men on average. However, women on some types of intelligence, men and women do differently. And spatial intelligence is one of those. So spatial intelligence is a type of intelligence that allows you to read maps well, or visualize environments in three dimensions and like sort of rotate them and navigate through them in your head. It's that sort of intelligence. And men are on average significantly better at that than women are. And that type of intelligence is precisely the type of thing that's very useful for navigation and piloting ships. Now, there's no reason to think that the women the captain in this case was incompetent or had deficient spatial intelligence or any of this stuff. I wasn't talking about her. By all accounts, she's very competent. And by all accounts, she did a good job in declaring the emergency and to evacuate the ship in time. And she may have saved lives. So I have nothing against her at all. It was just the fact that people were talking about women and differences between men and women on Twitter that spurred me to make the comment.
I saw another funny comment that I think wasn't supposed to be funny, but somebody was making quite a serious case saying that, well, men have been piloting ships and sailing for thousands of years. Men have sunk a lot of ships in that time, made a lot of mistakes and learned. Now that we're finally allowing women to sail ships and command ships and you know, be in the Navy, you've got to give women some time to learn the same mistakes. And so you should be able to expect that more ships will be sunk by women in the coming century, you know, as women adjust to sailing ships. And I think this was a serious argument that was made by a leftist, but it kind of blew up because it was funny, because people thought it was hilarious to suggest that because of diversity, equity, inclusion, you should expect more ships to get sunk, you know, just in, for the sake of equality.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that. I mean, I have the very simple view that you ought to hire the best person for the job, whether they're a man or a woman. And that if you do that, you're going to, in the case of ships, you're going to have less sunk ships. And in the case of every other profession too, you're going to have less bad things happen if you have the best person for the job.
And just more broadly on this, to wrap up this subject, because we had kind of a strange case where the government sort of welcomed back our returning heroes when all of the sailors were safely brought back from Samoa, kind of put in such a way that this was there was nothing sort of dishonorable or shameful about the fact that this crew and this captain had sunk a ship, which is, I think, about 25% of our fleet, roughly, maybe a little bit less than that, but that's the joke anyway. To think that this is sort of part of this whole diversity, equity, inclusion, part of the whole managerial bureaucracy, is that like, oh, it's nobody's fault, you know, maybe it was just a mechanical failure. Nobody's to blame. There's no shame on anybody. We'll just kind of smooth things over, which maybe you would do in a, you know, it's good for a workplace morale in a non-consequential industry where you want to make sure your team members are all, you know, working effectively. But in a kind of situation where you're talking about combat and people's lives are on the line, that's actually overall a very harmful way to treat people, to say, well, oh well, it's nobody's fault. Everybody's a hero.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the next step would be giving them participation certificates. But there is a sort of sad thing about the modern hero. We used to have a sort of culture of honor, and if you made a mistake, if you were at fault, then the noble thing to do was to own up to it and resign from your job. And this is even taken to further lengths in the case of sea captains, who had a tradition of going down with the ship. So if the ship sunk, you sunk with it if you were the captain, and that was the noble thing for you to do. Now, we don't do that anymore, and maybe it's okay that we don't do that anymore, but there is some sort of logic to that way of behaving that we don't have anymore. Everything, you're right, everything is the fault of the system these days, and human agency and human decision-making and concepts of honor don't come into it and aren't allowed to come into it in any way.
I was a young child, I think, when I asked my dad about the planes. I said, well, why don't they have parachutes on the planes? You know, said, well, you know, it's difficult to use a parachute. You know, something was wrong in it. But, you know, well, I said, what about the pilots? So obviously they could, you know, the pilots could have a parachute, right? They'd be trained to use it. I said, well, if we gave the pilots parachutes, then maybe they'd, you know, bail on the plane, right? Like the point is that the pilot has to go down with the plane. If the plane's going down, you can't have the pilot survive. And I kind of realized, well, I learned a little lesson there, and kind of, you know, the importance, like just how important that job is, as it would be, that if something goes wrong, then you have to die as well. And in that sort of situation. And yeah, if it was in a case of a ship, it's nice if everybody can get off alive, as they did in this case. But at least the overall lack of the responsibility sitting with someone, that seems to be the initial response. Get rid of that. Oh, we'll do some investigation and maybe we'll whitewash the whole thing. Seems, you know, you think of many different inquiries that we've done, even the COVID one that's going on now. If we talk about the Christchurch terror attack one as well, oh, we'll just whitewash everything. Nobody's responsible. Nobody made a mistake. Actually, we may just segue right into the coroner's inquest, which I think the second phase of that started last week, into that terror attack, saying, which you know, the police had sort of been absolved of any kind of responsibility in how they issued a firearms license to a terrorist and so on. So perhaps you've got some comments that you'd like to give us on this subject as well, since I think it's a good parallel.
Yeah, well, the Royal Commission of Inquiry already looked at these subjects, and now the coronial inquest is going over the same ground. The Royal Commission of Inquiry concluded that the main problem was that police didn't have sufficient guidance, didn't have sufficient training in assessing the and how to assess people for their firearms license. And crucially, they didn't check whether Brenton Tarrant's referees knew him well enough to really be referees. So the guy came into the country, and within 15 days, he's using a gaming friend that he, I'm not sure, even knew personally apart from over the computer, and the gaming friend's father as his referees. And police didn't do their due diligence and check whether those were appropriate to be referees. That's how he got a firearms license. That's how he was able to buy his guns. And that oversight by police allowed the terrorist attack to happen. So that's the main takeaway. But I think what they're trying to sort of say is a lot of stuff has come in after the Christchurch terror attack, after the Royal Commission of Inquiry's report. It's sort of been used in a way to bed in woke ideology right across the public sector, including into New Zealand police. And in the last few months, we've had these reports of police turning up unannounced in some cases to people's houses and questioning them about tweets they've put up on social media, or maybe not always Twitter, but other social media posts they've put up, and threatening to take their firearms licenses away over those posts. And I think that behavior and that, you know, it's driven by the same sort of thing that has them doing the police hate speech training or hate crime training. All this stuff came out of the Royal Commission of Inquiry's report. And I think that's not really the main thing. The police didn't do their job right in assessing Brenton Tarrant's, whether he should have a firearms license. But they're putting it back into an ideological thing, using it as an excuse to go after people who have more conservative or more right-wing political beliefs and making life difficult for them.
Yeah, they're using the kind of the giant hole that Jacinda Ardern put into the firearms legislation as well to say, oh, if you have extremist or hateful beliefs or something along those lines, or things that can be seen as being hateful and extremist, that's roughly the interpretation the police have taken. And we've interviewed Gareth, there's nobody on X, I'll just refer to him as Gareth Nobody. It's not his real name, but it's a good enough alias. And he basically got a visit from police because he had posted some things online, some of which was satirical, but none of which promoted violence in any way or could be considered to be hateful or extremist, tending to violence or anything like that, encouraging violence. Some of it was even as simple as saying he thought all regulations were, not all regulations, but there were too many regulations, like libertarian kind of thing, or too many regulations. Saying he didn't really trust police that much. I guess police have had, that people have had their trust in the police eroded. And then they came back and used all of that to say, oh, well, we don't think you're fit and proper to have a firearms license anymore now because you said you didn't like the police, basically. So instead of them making any kind of sane application of whether or not somebody may be crazy or unstable or willing to commit violence, or which usually people who know that person would be pretty good at telling you. Instead, they're simply, as you said, going for people's political opinions and saying, oh, you have political opinions that go against the police have been instructed are acceptable political opinions. And this kind of comes round to the issue we were talking about before with Victoria banning certain bits of political expression. Just to put it into other legislation to say, well, okay, it's not a crime. It's not a crime to have these political views, but we're going to make sure you can't have a firearms license. We're going to harass you about it, even though there's nothing that would be linked to violence in any way. In fact, usually people who are engaging in politics are less likely to resort to violence because they have some kind of stake in the political process. It's the entire point of having a democracy and having a political system is that people can engage in power and the transition of power in a peaceful way. And you basically now have the police trying to lock people out of this by saying, well, you can't actually talk about politics. You've got to keep that to yourself, which that is not going to make the situation any better. Like they've, as you say, taken the complete wrong lesson, seemingly deliberately, because they're just using it to put this diversity policy into action. And you've got, and I'm sure of it, you've got these HR ladies, and maybe some effeminate men as well, sitting behind their desks in Wellington, and they're scouring the internet and reports and emails and getting their snitches, you know, to send things in. And then they'll be instructing frontline police to go and harass these people. You know, the frontline police aren't making these decisions. There are people behind the scenes who are giving them these instructions and sitting at these desks in these offices, just looking for an excuse to go and harass someone.
Yep. That's what's happening.
So that was my rant. There was no question there.
Well, I mean, I agree with the rant. Yeah.
And we're out of time here today. We may just finish with one bit of good news. TVNZ has announced it's in a little bit of trouble, and it's going to shut down the One News website, and they're making a bunch of other changes. So final comment for you on what do you think is happening with the media space in New Zealand with free speech? As we've already highlighted, the media has sort of gambled against free speech, aligned itself against free political expression, and they seem to be losing that gamble. If you're shutting down your website, especially in this digital age where the number of people who own TVs are going down, it's a bit of a bizarre decision to keep your TV channel and shut down your news website. But I suspect that the money they get from the government kind of has to be used for maybe TV broadcasting purposes more so. And so they're being forced to focus on that. But it seems like they've just completely shot themselves in the foot now, because TV viewership is only going down. So this is basically the end, as far as I'm concerned, of One News and TVNZ, if they're deleting their news reporting on their website news reporting.
Yes. Trust in media is going down. It's been going down for a while, but it started to drop more precipitously around the time of the COVID response and around the time of the Labor government funneling large amounts of money into the media in order for them to cover certain things in a way that they like. So they attach conditions to the way they had to, when they signed up for the Public Interest Journalism Fund, they had to cover Maori issues a certain way. They had to cover, you know, make sure that their coverage was in line with the treaty principles or something like that, which, of course, you can't be a media organization and have a partisan view on the treaty principles. A lot of people disagree with it. You know, the treaty principles, and so those people's views are being excluded. They also gave them a whole bunch of COVID advertising money, and so they, you know, the TV was blaring out, go and get vaccinated, and two shots for summer or something.
Don't give people PTSD by mentioning any of this. That's we're going to trigger terrible flashbacks.
So every time you listen to the political reporting, they're always saying stuff that gets on your nerves. There's only so much of that stuff you can watch before it gets on your nerves and you turn them off. And a lot of people are turning them off. Now, a lot of advertising was going away for other reasons as well. People's eyeballs are more on social media and stuff than they are on the traditional news these days. So they're getting less advertising money because they're getting less eyeballs. But yeah, I just think they're in a bad situation. They went all in, sucking up to the government, hoping the government would bail them out indefinitely. But that ruined their trust with the public. And now they're not even much good to the government anymore, because their only value to the government comes from them being trustworthy and people watching them. And if you've blown that, the government's not going to give you any money either.
Absolutely right. And for the listeners, I give you an encouragement to support Reality Check Radio if you're not already. If you're not a foundation member, just go through to the website, sign up. The only way that you can keep alternative media going, let alternative media grow, have these discussions that we're having here, being able to call in to RCR and say whatever you want, being able to write in, mostly uncensored, is something that you need to support. So whatever it is, whether it's RCR or other independent media organizations in New Zealand, I just want to encourage you to give some actual support, financial support, to us or to them, and that is going to make the situation in New Zealand a lot better, and we can turn all of this around and be the real voice of reason and be a good bulwark against the kind of propaganda that these legacy media organizations are putting out and that the government is putting out.
That's right.
And thank you for joining me, William. I'm going to be away on holiday for the next month, but I look forward to returning, and I look forward to doing a big, I guess, US election special retrospective in about a month's time.
Well, happy travels, Dewa, and I look forward to catching up when you get back.
And to all of the listeners, we will be right back after this break.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.
Taking part in conversations and discussions to help find resolutions for the issues of today. This is The Dialogue with Dewa DeBoer.
Well, I was planning on reading out a piece that I had written for Good Oil News on the census and statistics, but I think that William and I really covered it in quite a bit of detail, so I won't read the whole thing out. But you can go to rightminds.nz and read that, www.rightminds.nz, the 2023 Census and Multicultural Identity. And in that piece, I sort of go over exactly, I think, what the statistics mean for how multicultural strategy is being deployed by political parties, how it's effectively unavoidable. You know, whatever we think of it, it's sort of inevitable now that some kind of identitarian politics basically is a done deal. And even if you look at, for instance, the percentage of people who are identifying just as Maori on the census, and then you look at the polling of the Maori Party and so on, you'll see that sometimes it's said, well, you know, the claim of a million Maori, and so only a small minority of them are supporting the Maori Party. But if you look at those who are actually just purely identifying as Maori, you'll see that actually an outright majority of these people are supporting the Maori Party. So this means that there are effectively groups that are organized around ethnic lines that are demanding a piece of the action, a piece of the political pie, as it were. And we are going to have to deal with that one way or another. But I won't go on for any longer than that. Now it is time for the mailbag, and my wife Amy joins us as always to go through your feedback and comments and all of the messages that you sent in last week. Welcome back to the show, Amy.
Thank you, Dewa. It's nice to be here as always. Let's go through the general feedback first. I got in a message here that said, "Hi, I just listened to some of the dialogue with Dewa DeBoer, and I caught a conversation around gender and ideas society is mentally unwell when we accept men being women, etc. I'm just going to say there is a direct correlation in numbers of gender confused and autism. If we understand autism, it makes sense. The real question is, why are the numbers so high and what caused it? Yes, it's a mental illness, and contradictory behavior is part of it. We need to understand men, women, and others now exist. And most gender confused are unable to empathize with the viewpoints of others. It's not something that can be changed. We need to educate about autism."
If I were to put it rather bluntly, I guess the biggest issue on the connection between autism and this so-called gender dysphoria is really that autistic kids likely make for easier targets to groom into this kind of behavior, especially because they can get very fixated on particular things. So if you get them fixated or hooked on a particular idea, you could plant that seed in their mind. This is far more effective, in this case, in a very negative way, on autistic kids. And so that's why I think you see that very strong correlation between the two. And it would be very bad to accept that as normal. And autistic kids, fewer social skills, more isolated, and so on. There's, of course, an entirely separate issue here around autism and it going through the roof. And rates of autism are increasing, and I go back and forth on this, both extremes, where I say 90% of autism is fake, largely a discipline problem, a lack of will. But I also go back to the other side, that it's a problem caused by all of this fake food, poison in the water, pharmaceuticals, various medical interventions and so on. Maybe it's even a combination of both. You know, maybe a lot of it is made up in the sense, or even like a social contagion. Perhaps the woke mind virus, as Elon Musk calls it, is an interesting way of thinking of it. So just educating about autism is not going to solve the problem. But if we think of it like the woke mind virus, but what transgenderism is, then we can think of like, how do you protect against this mind virus? How do you understand the mind virus? And how do you protect the people that you love from it? And of course, as a society, how do we make laws that will make it a lot harder for these groomers to target autistic kids and so on? And how do we make society healthy again so that we have fewer autistic kids? And whether the health in this case is a discipline, or whether it's better food and less pharmaceuticals and less poison in the water, as Alex Jones, of course, would say famously, when there was the chemicals in the water were turning the frogs gay, which has sort of been proven true, in that you had these androgynous or frogs ended up having traits of both sexual organs and traits. And you could sort of look at transgenderism that way, where it's the chemicals in the water turning the frogs gay. And maybe that's, turning people gay. The kids are being turned into these, being affected both with autism and with the issue of transgenderism. So maybe there's actually a more direct correlation there, in terms of what's causing it, that we could have a little think about. I don't know. I'm just going to think about that, and who knows, maybe someone else has had further ideas on there that I could follow up on.
I have a comment here from Rosa. She says, "Hi Dewa, I do enjoy your show, especially your music choices. William's wind-up is also a great overview of what has been happening. Keep up the good work."
Thanks for that comment, Rosa, and the idea there of calling the weekly roundup William's wind-up, I like that. I think maybe that's a I could put that in the naming suggestions. We renamed the segment to William's wind-up. I'm glad you appreciate us covering sort of issues over a broader span of time, because there is a bit of a balance to be struck between covering the latest, hottest issues and also going back over a couple of weeks and trying to draw back a handful of things. There's this ephemeral nature in current events. We're always moving on to the next thing. We're chasing the next thing. And I enjoy these common themes, recurring themes, recurring issues, tying threads together from different countries and continents. And I remember recently being asked what I sort of took away from a lot of the interviews I was doing overseas. And I was always struck by how similar these issues that we're facing are. And so it's good to, over a period of time with William, come back and be able to say, "You hear, we talked about this issue a couple of weeks ago, a couple of months ago. Here's the same thing coming up again and again." And that it solves that problem, I think, of always chasing the latest current events. So thank you, and I hope you enjoyed this week's segment as well.
Over on Facebook, we had a soundbite up. "A logical fallacy, the Waitangi Tribunal's criticism of the ACT treaty redefinition." Someone said, "The treaty principles were never a thing. They need to get rid of them altogether."
That is a common comment that we get on the treaty principles. And of course, it's a fairly common view, perhaps not quite as common as the other two views at the moment. The issue with the principles is that they were invented by judges and lawyers. They were useful to these revisionist academics, politicians. And so the cat is out of the bag. Right? How do you deal with this old document that is being used to as the basis of ongoing settlements, ongoing agreements? You know, money is changing hands, various other deals are being made. In some cases, perpetual deals that go on, payments go on forever. And so just completely binning the idea that there are principles has become politically infeasible, because you've got both constituencies on both sides that are going to keep this a live issue. So no matter what you do, you've got two sides here battling it out, it'll stay a live issue. So you've got to rein them in somewhat, and also you've got to solve the issue in a way that's democratically valid, that has legitimacy, that people are forced to say, okay, there has been some kind of constitutional decision made by the people in some kind of referendum, because it's essentially a constitutional issue. So a very fundamental way of how the government is run, how the country works. So that seems like it'll happen anyway, whether or not we'll end up with no principles, or, as I think is more likely, some principles of some kind. We may simply have to deal with the pragmatic that, this is not, maybe we have a situation where we say this is not the best deal, but it's the best we can get. And I was talking with Elliot about that earlier, where he was talking about the Treaty Principles Bill and bits that he liked, bits he didn't like, bits they're going to try and push to change. But the key thing to take away is, of course, that we want something better than the status quo.
I'll also read a comment here that we got on our Redneck and Beyond, the Double Standard and Acceptable Insults. Helen says, "Weird, I don't find it derogatory to be called a redneck. It probably is one of the top 50 words that you could use to describe me. Being offended is a personal choice, and I'd rather live in a world of rednecks than politicians."
Well, I'm glad you feel that way. And of course, like many things that are intended to be derogatory or an insult, people take them and own them. Many words started that way. In fact, the term that we use to describe Christians, the Christian, was originally supposed to be an insult. That was, I can't remember which church in Asia Minor it was first leveled at by the local inhabitants. And hey, 2,000 years later, we're using it, and it's normally used in a very positive way. But the context that we're talking about here with rednecks and Chris Hipkins is that he was being intentionally rude to effectively a particular ethnic descriptor. And the reason he didn't get called out for it is because the media hate you. Media hate rednecks. Anyone who could be described as a redneck, anyone who could be described as a redneck, the political left, Christopher Hipkins, the leader of the opposition, the legacy media, all of them, they really dislike you. And so think of it that way, that there's this contempt out there for you, and we are the only ones pushing back on it. And of course, I'm glad you consider yourself to be a redneck and you consider it to be a positive thing, but we will continue to speak out on your behalf.
That's all I have for this week. Thank you everyone for listening in, and please send in comments or questions that you might have about this week's show. Thanks, guys.
Well, thank you, Amy, and I'm looking forward to our holiday. That's all I can really say. And to all of the listeners, thank you very much for listening to the shows today. On behalf of the entire team at RCR, we really appreciate all of your interactions, and we hope you have an enjoyable rest of the day. Remember that replays come right after this, but tomorrow, Tuesday, 7 a.m., Paul Brennan will return. And I will remind you as well that Simon O'Connor is going to be guest hosting next week, because I will be away for a few weeks, but I think Simon and perhaps even William will be covering a couple of those shows. There's also a public holiday nested in there somewhere. And Amy and I are celebrating our 10th wedding anniversary, and so I will be taking her away on a little holiday. And it has been a while since we've had a good holiday, with everything that's gone on in the last few years, not being able to travel and so on. So again, appreciate all of you, and I look forward to being back behind the microphone sometime in mid-November. So let me leave you with this one final piece of classical music, a cantata by Johann Sebastian Bach, and its English name, "What God Ordains Is Always Good."
Thanks for tuning in to The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer. You can catch The Dialogue replays on our website at www.realitycheck.radio/replays.